This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer is our host, and Tom, Dave Beek has joined us before on the program, and it's a pleasure to have him back.
It really is. He was here last August when the weather was so delightful, and of course today we're digging out from 9 to 10 inches at my home. Dave, I know you have a monster driveway. How hard was that?
Well, not very hard because my plow guy came in at about 4 in the morning and plowed it. Of course, he dropped the plow on the driveway and I heard it. That was the tough part.
All right. Well, it's glad we're great and thankful for you to be back here, Dave, after being on here so many times already. But we really have a topic that just seems to never end, and that is the filing and protection of intellectual property under our patent law system.
That's correct. And, you know, intellectual property provides just increasingly a very large percentage of the value of companies and businesses in their ability to make products and their ability to sell their products and capture value. And they find that if they can't take the necessary steps to be able to patent their inventions, protect their trade secrets, whatever, that the competitors will just come along and they'll copy it and get a free ride and have none of the research costs. So that's what intellectual property is about.
Right. And you are a registered patent attorney. You are admitted to practice before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And you've been practicing in this field for how many years?
More than I care to remember, 23 years.
Very good. And we'll be talking about some of your experiences here that are pertinent to foreign patents, which is the topic today, because we have spent a number of shows, I think you've been on about four or five times, talking about various aspects of United States patent law, the history of that law and the scope of that law and how one gets a patent. And we'll be touching on some of those things today in our show as well. But also today really focusing on the global reach of the intellectual property law system and in particular foreign patents, which are a term that I'm sure strikes many folks as being an oddity, given what we see in the newspaper about, you know, other industrializing or developing countries basically taking our intellectual property.
Well, yes, and there's certainly always a lot of anecdotal evidence, which is in the eye of the beholder. The patent system has been harmonized across the globe to a much greater degree than existed 15 years ago. And as part of that process, countries like China, India have agreed to make their legal system available in order to enforce patents that are issued in their country. Now, obviously, you've got to walk before you can run, and I'm not sure that their legal systems are quite as far in terms of development of impartiality as our U.S. system, but from what I hear, I think they're getting there.
All right. Well, let's talk about the basics. First of all, a patent is a legalized monopoly, in effect, on an idea.
Well, we like to try to stay away from the word monopoly, but it's a government-granted right to exclude others from practicing the invention based upon your disclosure of how to practice the invention to others so they can practice it once the patent expires. And also then based upon your satisfaction of the patent office that you have made enough of a inventive step that you're worthy of receiving patent protection.
The idea being that for as an incentive to invent and to turn your invention over to the public, you get a certain number of years to have the sole and exclusive use of that particular invention.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, these rights are actually enshrined in our United States Constitution, and for a good reason. People are going to have considerably less incentive to spend their time and their money at their own risk to research and develop new products and processes if they're not going to then be able to reap rewards.
Some say, though, that the patent law inhibits development, particularly in third world and developing countries who don't have access to our research and development and thus have to spend more for the use of the patented technology. But What's your answer to that?
Well, you know, I guess that would then tie into our topic of foreign patents. You know, a U.S. company is only going to be able to prevent an Indian company from using their base patented technology to make improvements if that U.S. company had the foresight to go out and get a corresponding patent in India.
So let's rewind the tape a little bit. When I'm an inventor and I have an American patent granted by the United States mm-hmm. government, what rights do I have in terms of enforcing that patent in other parts of the world or in protecting sales here in the United States?
Well, you know, every country of the world is a sovereign entity. And so you can't take a United States patent and go up to Canada and try to enforce it in their court. They're going to look at you funny and say, well, you know, in case you didn't notice, we're Canada. We're not the United States. So a United States patent is going to give the patent owner the right to exclude others from making, using, selling that invention in the United States. And there's also a scenario where if the patent covers a process, it's going to prevent somebody from practicing that process outside of the United States just for purposes of bringing the product back into the United States. Other than that, that is really the extent of the geographic limits of the U.S. patent. Now, if I've got a great invention and I want to be able to prevent somebody from practicing it in Canada, I'm going to need to apply for and obtain a corresponding patent in Canada.
Now, we're going to be talking about that procedure in a moment, but for the moment, let's focus on some more of the broad concepts. Are foreign countries looking at inventions for the same kinds of things to determine whether a patent ought to be granted? That is to say, is it a new idea? Is it a new invention? Does it advance the state of a particular technology?
Yes. The system of examination is really quite similar across most countries of the world. They're going to look at the application to make sure that it adequately describes the invention so that then once the patent expires, someone else can practice it. That's part of the bargain for getting a patent. They're going to look at what we call prior art, and that is basically everything that came beforehand in your invention, what the collective body of knowledge was, and they're going to satisfy themselves that your invention is both new over what was previously known and also didn't represent an obvious advance.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Thanks so much for joining us after the football game on this Saturday. Tom Schroyer is in, Dave Beek is in. For more info on this program and all our other programs here on Minnesota Law, go online, moss-barnett.com. We'll return in a moment here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know a team of Moss and Barnett attorneys worked on the appeal of the case that served as the basis for the motion picture, North Country?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
There's no reason to miss your favorite WCCO programs. Broadcast them at WCCORadio.com.
It is Minnesota Law, a little bit later than normal today because of a football game. Tom Schroyer in studio along with Dave Beek. Thanks so much for joining us on Minnesota Law, Tom.
Thanks again, Steve. We're here with Dave Beek talking about foreign patents. Dave, you've been a patent lawyer, as you were saying, for about 23 years or thereabouts, and you've had tremendous experience working on American patents. How often does your practice involve working up a foreign patent or multiple foreign patents for the same invention?
Well, you know, I would estimate that probably in terms of our clients that I work with, in 75% of the cases of clients who file a United States patent application, they probably also then file some sort of foreign patent application.
That's really remarkably high.
Well, I think it's really a reflection of the fact that, you know, we all live in a global world and it's a global business environment, and a lot of the kinds of products and processes that they develop that are innovative have just as much commercial applicability outside of the United States as they do inside the United States. So unless they really are convinced as part of their business plan that they're never going to want to practice their inventions and try to reap commercial rewards outside the United States, they're going to want some sort of foreign protection.
What would the reason be for not filing for foreign patent protection?
Well, as I just indicated, if they just didn't think they were ever going to want to sell their product outside of the United States, if they didn't think they had any competitors who might want to sell the product outside of the United States, then they might say that really the costs of obtaining foreign patent protection exceed the benefits. Similarly, foreign patent applications are published. And so all of the information that's contained in the application is going to be deeded over to the public domain. In the United States, we can still keep our application secret up until patent grant, unless our clients go ahead, of course, and file any foreign applications. So, you know, if they're not sure, let's say hypothetically, that they're going to be able to get U.S. protection, then they might want to avoid that publication so they could try to maintain their trade secrets in case the U.S. patent doesn't go through.
That gets back to that tension we were talking about or alluding to, perhaps be a better way to say it earlier, and that is to say one of the trade-offs for getting a patent is that you have to disclose enough about your invention so that other people can pick it up from that disclosure and make it themselves when your patent expires. But if you're Coca-Cola, you don't want to ever reveal that magic formula because then everybody else in the world could make it after your patent expires.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, Coca-Cola's formula is probably it is one of the most famous trade secrets in the history of man. And certainly they were smart not to file a patent application for that because they would have lost their protection a long time ago. Tom, let me just add also then another scenario where someone might not want to seek foreign protection. There are certain kinds of invention subject matter that just are not patentable in foreign countries.
As opposed to being patentable in America?
Exactly. Ah. And so business methods, we talked about that in a previous program. That's an example where really the United States is one of the only countries that allows that to be patented. There are many foreign countries that won't allow you to patent a pharmaceutical medicine because of concerns about what that could do to health care. There are some countries where they really strongly discourage the patenting of computer software. So if your invention is in one of these kinds of categories, it might make no sense to seek foreign patent protection.
So it's important for America to have foreign reach to our patents because we are so interconnected with the global economy. Our exports depend on that. Is there something we can do to get these countries to line up with our patent system a little bit better?
Well, you know, I think our government across many, many administrations is always trying to do that. And that's what you hear about esoteric things like GATT negotiations and TRIP negotiations and WTO. I mean, that's what that is all about. There was a lot of emphasis some years ago that was placed on patents. I think more recently they've been placing some of their focus on copyrights because of the wishes of the music industry and the film industry. It's a gradual process.
All right. I know that doing research for our program here, you and I came across some information that showed just how much patents and intellectual property contribute to the value of the United States. Some studies showing that because we have a strong patent law system, for example, we're able to generate, according to studies, 72% more value per employee than we would have without patent law protection. That's really quite remarkable.
Well, yes. And again, that just reflects the fact that a substantial amount of the value that businesses create is this intellectual property information that's in their employees' heads and is embodied in their products and their processes. Gone are the days where our U.S. companies were really built on bricks and mortar and, hard manufacturing assets. I remember some years ago seeing a piece on Microsoft, and I think at that time Microsoft's market cap was something like $50 or $60 billion. And of that, the part that was hard assets like desks and bricks and mortar was $50 million or something like that. I mean, they're an extreme example, but it just shows for, you know, company after company that I could mention how much of their value is this kind of intellectual property and why intellectual property has been so important in terms of providing ways to protect it.
We have much more on the way. Dave Beek in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host. It is Minnesota Law. A little bit later than normal. We typically come your way Saturdays at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
News Radio 830 WCCO. Streaming online right now at WCCOradio.com.
We continue. It is Minnesota Law on a Saturday. Thanks so much for joining us. For more information about this program and all our other programs on Minnesota Law, we invite you to go online, moss-barnett.com. That's moss-barnett.com. We have program archives, podcasts, and background information on our programs there. Tom Schroyer is our host, Dave Beek in studio. Great to see Dave again, and always a fascinating topic. Tom?
It is indeed, and following up on your comment about podcasts, Dave Beek has a nice library being built on our website on patent law. So folks who are interested in more than just our today topic on foreign patents can find really quite an extensive bibliography about the topic on podcast from Dave, and so we encourage folks to check that out. As we continue, though, today to explore foreign patents with Dave Beek, a registered patent attorney at Moss & Barnett, we're talking about the efficacy of filing foreign patents. And so, Dave, not to put too fine a point on it, but let's face it, China is the big 900-pound or billion-pound gorilla in the room. How are they on patent honoring patents and allowing us to patent our inventions over in China?
Well, they are, excuse me, they're certainly part of the world patenting system. I probably have prosecuted, 15, 20 patent applications over in China over the years. I have found really their examiners to be very good. We have certainly gotten some very significant patents issued in China. So I don't really truthfully see that much of a difference between the quality of examination at the U.S. Patent Office versus the Chinese Patent Office. I haven't had any direct experience trying to enforce an issued Chinese patent in China. I know that they are trying to build their or base their legal system on the United States system so that it's similar, so that there's a lot of confidence that U.S. business people have in using the Chinese system. My perception is that it still helps to know people over in China when you're trying to vindicate your rights over there. But, you know, I don't think that they are flagrantly trying to rip people off.
And I would assume anybody who's invented a widget or has an improvement on a widget and pursues a patent here in the United States, chances are that product may eventually be manufactured overseas in China. And that's got to be scary for a lot of people, especially if you come up with this winning idea for manufacturing certain items or many items. China is the only option.
Well, that's correct. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why so many businesses that I work with do decide to seek patent protection in China. Because if you can get a patent issued in China, then you can either try to shut down those, you know, fly-by-night companies over there that are copying your product, or you can try to strike some sort of licensing deal where you allow them to manufacture the product and you control where it's going to be sold, and in return you get a nice royalty on it. If you don't play the system to try to get patent rights granted in China, then you really have no recourse.
And Dave, do they enforce the patent laws as vigorously as maybe we do here in the United States?
Well, you know, again, I don't have a lot of experience in actually litigating in China. I just haven't seen our clients get to the point yet of getting that point of their business plan.
I might jump in to say that in my litigation practice, we've had some run-ins with Chinese interests, and it is it's a whole different world over there in terms of even trying to get a court. And once that happens, to try to get it adjudicated, even the Chinese themselves have indicated to me that they'd rather litigate controversies in America, where, despite our reputation for jury roulette or perhaps gunslinging litigation, that we actually have a much better, much more advanced system for adjudication.
But it's something, though, that a business should be concerned of if you're going to do business, or especially if you have intellectual property of some sort or a patent. That has to be a concern.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, to go back to a point we made at the beginning of this program, a business has spent a lot of its own time and money developing a product, and if it doesn't choose to take the steps to protect the intellectual property in its products, it's like just leaving that on a street corner for anybody to come along and take. Guess what? You know, the Chinese are very, very skilled at adapting and copying, so chances are even greater that someone is going to take your product off the street corner and copy it.
Now, I know you haven't litigated in China, but you have litigated overseas to enforce patents. And as I understand it, you did that over in London.
Right. I've litigated a couple patent cases in London, and I have also litigated four cases at the European Patent Office in Munich. So I have had some experience.
Let's talk about that English justice. How did that compare to what you've seen in the United States?
Well, it was a lot more theatrical. All the judges like to wear wigs over there, but they have obviously a very developed legal system in the United Kingdom. Our United States system is predicated in many respects on it. Their judges are very good. The lawyers are very good. Excuse me. You do have trials by jury. Actually, they have special patent courts over in England, which ensures you of getting a very knowledgeable judge in patent law, which is more than we can say in many cases here in the United States. There are rules for discovery, fact-finding before trial, so that you can get information both to weigh the relative strength of your case and the relative strength of your opponent's case. It's a little different. So there are some differences.
And how about that European Commission? Was that a court? Was that just a bunch of arbitrators, judicial officers of some kind?
Those were panels of three judges at the European Patent Office, where I was trying to invalidate someone else's patent as being invalid over the prior art. These were big companies like DuPont, Pioneer, Monsanto, and maybe I was lucky, but I was 4-0 for invalidating them.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, it was a long plane ride for the other side back to the U.S.
And could you wear your wig in from the British litigation to one of our sessions?
Well, I could have, but the German and Dutch judges might have looked at me a little crossways.
Oh, okay.
But what about those courts? Are they similar to what you experienced in Britain, or how are they different from maybe Great Britain or the United States?
Well, those were European Patent Office courts. So, you know, I guess I would call them more like hearings, but hearings with extremely skilled examiner-type judges. I mean, these were people who really knew patent law inside and out. And so we were given an opportunity to state our position. The other side was given an opportunity to state their position, rebuttal. We were able to bring witnesses, documentary evidence, and then you would receive an actual indication from the judges right there before you left how they were going to rule. You didn't have to wait for a month to get the written ruling in the mail.
How expensive is it to apply for patents throughout the entire world? I know it can get to be quite expensive, even just focusing on the United States to prosecute a patent application.
Well, it can. And, you know, we take as the starting point the fact that you have already spent the money to have your patent application prepared. That's what you file typically in the United States. So you've got a couple routes you can use when you're going foreign. One is you can file a bunch of applications in individual countries of interest. You typically have to do that within 12 months after you file your U.S. application so that you can reach back to claim what we call priority so you can receive the same treatment filing later in Canada as if you had filed back when you filed your original U.S. application. That's very important for beating out prior art. Those direct, what we call national applications, depending upon how many you file, can get expensive. You know, Canada probably is on the cheaper end of the scale. That might be $4,000, say, to file an application. A country like Japan, where it's more expensive to begin with, and then you have to file translations, you could be looking at $10,000 to file that application.
Now, you're just talking about filing fees with the government. You're not talking about the fees for the local attorneys and for the American attorney to work up the application, right?
No, that would include the fees for the local Japanese firm that we would use, and typically ours as well. Now, once you file it, then, like in the United States, you're going to have your application examined.
Okay.
You're going to have some to-ing and fro-ing back and forth. So that is certainly going to add some cost. And then you also have what are called annuity fees. And so every year that your application is on file, and then after your patent issues, you've got to pay a fee to keep your patent application or your patent in force, and these increase over time. And just to show how expensive it can be, actually obtaining and then maintaining 10 patents in place in a foreign country for an invention could certainly run $250,000. Now, that's going to be, you know, over 20 years. Hopefully, your business is generating a lot of sales revenue in the meantime, particularly after the patent issues, so that your benefits are certainly exceeding your costs. But I don't want to have anybody think that this is, you know, an inexpensive exercise. There certainly is a lot of cost.
Sure. And I know that you work with lawyers all over the world. Do you have a regular network that you work with that you've developed relations with so you know that they're reliable and cost effective and effective?
Well, I do. And these are all law firms that I have accumulated over the years by actually going over and meeting with them, interviewing them, determining what their capabilities are, both as attorneys but also as practitioners of the English language, because that certainly helps a lot with communication. Their reliability. These are people that I rely upon. If I'm filing something in Europe, I know they're going to do it the right way.
We have more on the way. Dave Beek, Tom Schroyer in studio. Final segment of the program coming up. By the way, if you want more information on this program, podcasts of other programs, go online. Moss-Barnett.com is the website. More in a moment here on News Radio, 830-WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorneys handled the first reported products liability case in the history of Minnesota for a defective tire back in 1967?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
WCCO, now available crystal clear on 102.9 WLTE HD2, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Welcome back one more time. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. A little bit later on this Saturday, due to the football game earlier in the day, we will be on next Sunday afternoon at 5. We'll have more on that program in a moment. Tom Schroyer, Dave Beek in studio. And Dave, I wanted to ask, what about the flip side of this? Foreign companies that want to file patents in the United States, I'm sure there's a lot of that going on as well.
There absolutely is, Steve, and has been for a very long time. There are more Japanese companies that file applications in the United States than American companies. German companies are also very heavy practitioners, and for a very good reason. These are countries where companies are making heavy, heavy patent filings in their own countries. They value the United States market very greatly, and so they are then, from their perspective, foreign filing in the United States.
We were talking in the last segment, Dave, about the costs of obtaining patent protection overseas for an inventor. Is there a cheaper way that's now available, less costly way that's now available to do the filing in one fell swoop?
Well, there is, and we call it the Patent Cooperation Treaty. It's been in force since 1978. It has about 134 or so countries signed up, including most all the major industrialized countries. And instead of filing all of those individual direct national applications I talked about before the last commercial, you can file one PCT application for about $4,000. Now, that does two things. It helps you avoid initially all of the individual filing costs. It also allows you to put off the more expensive translation costs if you're dealing with countries where translations would be necessary. And then you are going to have another year and a half approximately until you have to go into what we call national stage proceedings in the countries of continued interest where the examinations would take place. Now, you can take that 18-month period and you can use it to see how things are firming up for your invention, your product in the marketplace. Figure out which countries are really most important, which countries will give you the greatest benefit-to-cost ratio for seeking patent protection, and then at the proper time period, go forward with those. So most of our clients will, if they want foreign patent protection, file a PCT application because it's just a great cost-effective way to be able to have your cake and eat it too.
It strikes me that this is an important development and one that also requires you as the patent attorney to really be integral to the your client's strategic plan, their business plan, and their future technological development so that you can manage this onslaught of, if you will, patent applications throughout the world to make sure that you protect not only the today's technology but the envisioned advances to it.
Well, that's right. You know, I work very, very closely with our clients. I like them to have a business plan so I know where they're going in terms of running their business, where their strategy is. We then figure, based on that, what their intellectual property patent plan should be if it includes foreign protection. Rather than just turn this whole boat over to a bunch of foreign firms, we manage it here from the U.S. so that we are providing the proper instructions to the foreign associates to be able to overcome examiner rejections in those countries, and even more importantly, make sure that we're taking consistent positions across the globe and so that we're taking into account our own clients' continued developments and improvements to their inventions so that at the end of the day, they have a worldwide patent portfolio that provides value.
Always a great program. Dave, thanks for coming in again. I can't remember how many programs this is, but he is a regular, and it's always great, great information. Tom, next Sunday, another Best Of will be on Sunday at 5, and this was a great program as well, and with the holiday season, toys are in the spotlight.
Right. We'll be replaying the presentation by Matthew Meyer on the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which actually was sponsored by our own Senator Amy Klobuchar and has proven to be a bit controversial. But Matthew will be deconstructing all the rules from that to as they apply to the sale of children's toys.
Yes, selling toys. It's no longer child's play because of sports conflicts. We'll be on next Sunday at 5. We invite you to join us here on Minnesota Law. For more info on today's program and all our other programs, go online, moss-barnett.com. Thanks again to Dave Beek and Tom Scheuer. Once again, it is Minnesota Law here on News Radio 830 WCCO.